Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report. The number of high school students in the United States seeking federal aid to pay for college fell sharply following the sudden closure of school buildings last spring. The move cut off students in their final year of high school from school guidance counselors. At the time, families struggling with economic hardship began reconsidering plans for higher education. From the start of the coronavirus health crisis, the number of new requests for college aid fell by nearly half compared to levels 1 year earlier. The Associated Press, or AP news agency, studied U.S. government records. It found that the smaller number resulted, in large part, from a sharp drop among students at schools in low-income areas. The numbers have risen as states and schools have launched campaigns urging students to seek federal aid for a college education, but the numbers are still down from last year. This has raised concerns among U.S. education officials who say thousands of students may be choosing to delay or even avoid college. And this might have a serious effect on their future employment and earnings. The kids are going directly into the workforce. They're closing the door on post-high school learning, said David Nieslanik. He serves as principal of Southridge High School in Beaverton, Oregon. Nieslanik noted that he saw only students from more wealthy families seek out aid once classes moved online. The FAFSA is short for Free Application for Federal Student Aid. It is required for students to be considered for federal aid for a college or university education in the U.S. Students are often required to complete the form for state aid as well. Studies have found students who complete the FAFSA are far more likely to enroll in college. And those who receive assistance are more likely to stay in college. The AP found that in the 4 weeks starting March 13th, the number of completed applications was down 45% compared to the same period a year ago. The drop was greatest at Title I schools, a federal term for public schools that have larger shares of low-income students. In general, FAFSA applications were down by 70,000 as of June 19th. That represents a 3.7% drop for the entire application period. Even before the health emergency, some states had been expecting to see decreases. Yet, as COVID-19 spread, every state had lower numbers compared to 2019 levels. Schools say the public health crisis affected the decrease in more than one way. Separated from their schools, students lost contact with advisors who usually guide them through the complex financial aid process. Families without dependable internet service struggled to complete the form online. And as the U.S. economy weakened, some students took jobs and put college plans on hold. The timing of the crisis worsened its effect on low-income students, experts say. It came at the very worst time, said Gregory Cole, principal of the Mojave High School in North Las Vegas, Nevada. Many parents lost jobs as Nevada's gaming industry suspended operations. And some students took jobs in food stores or eateries. Adding to the problem was the fact many students come from families that had never filed the form. Once schools closed, guidance counselors could no longer invite students into their offices to talk or ask families to school to explain the FAFSA. Instead, schools were left sending emails that often went unanswered. Or they depended on unpredictable video conferencing services to help families with paperwork. Education officials are urging U.S. students to apply for financial aid over the summer, even if only to see how much money they could receive. The state of North Carolina recently launched a FAFSA Frenzy campaign, while Kentucky is holding FAFSA Fridays, urging students to apply. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Trees give so much to the world. They create oxygen and shade. They provide shelter to animals and insects. Trees are also a valuable resource. The wood they provide is used for buildings and other products we humans use and need. Trees are so important that some people have made it their goal to protect them. We call these people tree huggers. Word experts say this term first appeared in the 1900s. It describes people who support the protection of forests and oppose logging, the act of cutting down trees in an area for their wood. Today, the term tree hugger describes a person who is an environmentalist. They want to protect nature and the environment, but not just the trees. Someone who wants to save a rare butterfly species or cut greenhouse gases could also be described as a tree hugger. Calling someone a tree hugger is not always seen as a compliment. In earlier times, in fact, it was used as an insult. Tree hugger described someone who was seen as extreme, someone who was overly concerned about protecting trees, animals, and other parts of the natural world. Some tree huggers do go to extremes to protect trees. Take, for example, a woman named Julia Lorraine Hill. She is also known as Julia Butterfly Hill. She is an American environmental activist. For 738 days, from December 10, 1997, and December 18, 1999, Hill lived in a tree. But not just any tree. She lived in Luna, a redwood tree in Northern California's Humboldt County. Luna is huge, measuring nearly 61 meters tall and about 12 meters across. The ancient redwood has stood in Humboldt County for more than 1,000 years. But that did not stop the Pacific Lumber Company from wanting to cut it down. So Hill did what any extreme tree hugger would. She moved in. Hill lived in the tree for just over 2 years. The Sanctuary Forest website explains that she only came down from the tree when the Pacific Lumber Company agreed to protect Luna with a special conservation agreement. As the website explains, Hill's main goal was to bring international attention to the importance of protecting and restoring natural resources. So we can safely call Hill a tree hugger, and I'm sure that she would consider that the highest of compliments. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. I saw a tree by the riverside
one day as I walked. At the age of 87, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the oldest justice of the United States Supreme Court. She is also one of its longest serving and most liberal members. Last week, Ginsburg, who has survived cancer, worried her many supporters with the announcement that her cancer has returned. Everybody is checking their phones daily to see what Justice Ginsburg's health situation is, said Russell Wheeler. He is an expert at the Brookings Institution, a Washington policy and research center. Ginsburg was appointed by former Democratic President Bill Clinton in 1993. She said she has no plans to retire, but her supporters fear a court opening would permit President Donald Trump, a Republican, to appoint another conservative judge. The Supreme Court's decisions usually have a strong effect on every part of American life. Just this year, the court said that U.S. law protects gay and transgendered from workplace discrimination. It said employers can deny birth control health coverage to female workers based on religious beliefs. And it ruled that no citizen, not even the president in this case, could refuse to produce evidence for a state's criminal hearing. Justices in the United States Supreme Court are nominated by the president. After Senate confirmation, they can serve for life, but some choose to leave early. Ginsburg is not the only older Supreme Court justice likely to retire. Liberal Justice Stephen Breyer, another Clinton appointee, is 81. Republican-appointed conservative justices Clarence Thomas at 72 and Samuel A. Alito, Jr. at 70 are nearing retirement age. The court now has 5 conservative and 4 liberal members. 2 of its conservative justices, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, were appointed by Trump. In 2016, the Republican-controlled Senate refused to consider a nomination to the Supreme Court from President Barack Obama, a Democrat. As a campaigning move, Republican candidate Donald Trump released the names of conservatives who he would nominate to the court. Some conservative voters noted the move as a reason they voted for Trump. With at least one or more court openings possible, liberals are now hoping to make the Supreme Court's future an issue in the November presidential election in 2020. A group of liberal organizations has started buying $2 million worth of advertising in Arizona, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. These are the important states that could decide who becomes the next president. Donald Trump has hijacked our Supreme Court with far-right justices like Brett Kavanaugh, the project's first ad says, adding that Kavanaugh may serve for many more years. Courtney Perella is a Trump campaign spokeswoman. She defended the president's record of appointing solid, conservative federal judges. The president's record appeals to conservatives who supported him in 2016, appointing judges that will faithfully uphold the Constitution, Perella said. While agreeing that the November 3rd election will likely be decided by two issues, the coronavirus and the economy, Democrats say voters have begun to understand the importance of the Supreme Court. And there is some evidence of that. In April, a poll by Suffolk University and USA Today found that more Democrats than Republicans view the Supreme Court as a top issue. Yet the campaign of Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has not made the Supreme Court a campaign issue. The Biden campaign did not respond to several requests for comment. I'm Susan Shand.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Herbert Hoover. He took office in 1929. Hoover was president for the early years of what Americans call the Great Depression. During those years, the United States economy slid into a severe recession. Many banks and businesses failed. At times, nearly one in four people in the U.S. workforce were unemployed. Millions of people lost their homes and savings. Hoover did not cause the Depression. The conditions had been in place before he took office. But many Americans blamed Hoover for their suffering. They believed he permitted the economic crisis to continue and even deepen during his time in office. Her Herbert Hoover was born in a small house in the state of Iowa. His parents were Quakers. Their religion valued simplicity, hard work, equality among people, and peaceful resolution of conflict. Hoover and his brother and sister were influenced by these beliefs, even after their parents died. By the time young Herbert Hoover was 9, he was an orphan. He moved to the state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest and lived with an uncle. Hoover did not thrive in that situation. Reports say that he usually kept to himself, and he did not do particularly well in school. Yet one official from Stanford University liked what he saw in the young man: hard work and a desire to learn new things. At the time, Stanford University was just getting established. It admitted Hoover into its first class. Hoover had to work hard at Stanford, both in class and to earn money to pay tuition. But the experience brought many benefits. Hoover studied geology and went on to work as a mining engineer. The job led to positions in Australia, China, and other parts of the world. He became an internationally known expert on mining. He also wrote a leading textbook on mining. These experiences, along with good business investments, led to great wealth for Hoover. At Stanford, he also met the woman who would become his wife. Her name was Lou Henry. She was the first woman from Stanford to complete a study program with a degree in geology. The Hoovers went on to have 2 sons. During World War I, the Hoovers' lives changed dramatically. The family was living in London when the war began. U.S. government officials asked Hoover to organize an evacuation effort for American tourists who were in Europe. In only a few weeks, Hoover's committee succeeded. Later, he helped get food and supplies to people in Belgium. As a result, Hoover earned a public image as a smart, skilled humanitarian. When the United States entered World War I, President Woodrow Wilson asked Hoover to lead the government's Food Administration. In that position, Hoover led an effort to change Americans' behavior in order to support the war effort. He asked them to limit the kinds of food they ate and goods they bought. The effort was, for the most part, successful. Americans called their moves to limit their consumption to Hooverize. Hoover went on to organize programs to aid other countries, including Russia. He also helped parts of the U.S. recover after terrible flooding. And as Secretary of Commerce, he pushed businesses, researchers, and government officials to work together. Hoover aimed to reduce boom and bust cycles and keep the U.S. economy healthy. In all his efforts, Hoover urged Americans to choose to participate. He did not believe in using government requirements to force cooperation. Instead, he supported individualism, the idea that Americans must protect the qualities of creativity, equal opportunity, and service to others. Hoover's beliefs were popular with many Americans at the time, and with many Americans today. In the election of 1928, Hoover easily won the presidency. He promised to continue leading the country down the path of prosperity.
Thank you.
When Hoover took office in 1929, he said, "I have no fears for the future of our country. It is bright with hope." That was in March. In October, the U.S. stock market crashed. Thousands of investors lost their savings. The event was part of a sharp downturn in the economies of the United States and of many other countries. At first, Hoover believed the downturn would pass. But as time went on, the situation grew worse. Businesses could not expand their workforce. Farmers could not afford to harvest their crops. Everyday people had too little money to pay for housing costs and, in some cases, food. And then banks across the country began to fail. President Hoover worked hard to fix the problems. He tried many approaches, creating government agencies, urging private and public groups to cooperate, and working to balance the federal budget. But Hoover did not want to use federal money to provide direct aid to Americans. He worried that such actions would make people dependent on the government and reduce people's individual power and morale. Nor did he want to use the federal government to try to control the economy. Government intervention, he said, would lead to socialism and eventually destroy the country's founding beliefs. Instead, Hoover tried to support states and businesses indirectly and urged people to find ways to help one another. Yet many lawmakers and members of the public rejected Hoover's measures as insufficient and even cruel. Some used his name differently than they had before he took office. Now, they called the dirty shelters where hungry and homeless people lived Hoovervilles, and they called men's empty pockets Hoover flags. Although Hoover tried to persuade Americans that he was protecting their interests in the long run, voters refused to elect him for a second term. Instead, they overwhelmingly chose a president who promised an activist federal government and a hopeful New Deal for Americans. After they left the White House, the Hoovers retired to their home in Palo Alto, California. Lew Henry Hoover died in 1944, but Hoover lived 20 more years, many of them working for the public good. He helped international relief efforts, advised the U.S. government, and led committees to reform the presidency. Hoover also commented on later presidents and their policy decisions. He was especially critical of government programs set up to provide aid and intervention in Americans' lives. Until his death from cancer at the age of 90, Hoover remained committed to his beliefs. He spoke for limiting the power of the federal government and for supporting freedom of opportunity for individuals. But in the eyes of many Americans, Hoover is linked to the failure of the federal government to lessen the Great Depression. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.